The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 114.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show, one of my good buddies. He is the co-host of one of my favorite podcasts, Macro Voices. His name is Eric Townsend. Eric, welcome back to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
It's great to be back, George. Good to see you.
Yeah, now I know a lot of people out there, a lot of my viewers and listeners know your backstory from the time that you started Macro Voices, you started your own hedge fund, you've been managing money, you're a trader, you're really heavily involved in the oil market, but they don't realize that you were an entrepreneur at the very beginning before you got into this crazy macro stuff. And I know there's a lot of what I would call socialist tendencies as far as the narrative in the United States right now. And I just was very curious to get how you see these things playing out in the United States from a standpoint of being a former entrepreneur and creating jobs and hiring people, especially in California, because I think you're in Silicon Valley, weren't you?
Well, my company was based in New Hampshire, but we had operations in San Francisco. We had a branch office in downtown San Francisco. I thought you were starting to head down when you said socialist. There's a lot of, and I thought you were starting to draw me into that. I was about to hang up on you. Now that I finished the sentence, yes, I agree. I think what's going on here, really, big picture, first of all, it's the fourth turning that Neil Howe talks about. You get into this chapter of history, this season of history, and what happens is people lose faith in large institutions and they start to look towards extreme leaders, but also extreme views. So where you've always had a left and a right, what happens is the public conversation becomes more polarized. What used to be, I'm a liberal and you're a conservative, and you know, it's just not that big of a deal. We both go hang out at the same cocktail party and have a good time. And the fact that your political views are different from mine, you know, can we backtrack? Let me make you the liberal and me the conservative. I like that better. you're the liberal, I'm the conservative. We're at the cocktail party. We can just shrug it off and say, Hey, we don't happen to see things the same way, but you know, why ruin our evening talking about that? Let's talk about something else. What happens is in difficult times like this, when you have the economic tensions that we have and the social tensions that we have, all of a sudden political views become much more polarized and people get much more competitive. And all of a sudden, if you don't agree with my political views, then you're my enemy. And not only do I not hang out with you at cocktail parties, but in some extreme cases, people are literally, you know, getting out baseball bats and taking to violence in the streets with people whose views they disagree with. It's really not unexpected. It's what happens in fourth turnings. Now, I think that the current both socialism and also the focus on a perception of racism being the main issue in the country, I think that these are actually distortions of what's really going on. What's going on, in my opinion, is that we have a tremendous wealth inequality, which is very complex and hard for most people to understand because it involves things like monetary policy and how the Federal Reserve's efforts to resuscitate the economy are worsening a divide between the haves and have-nots. So you've got what, at its essence, I think the real issue is wealth inequality, and it is the old version of American capitalism, which was supposed to be, doesn't matter who you are or where you're from or who your family is, anybody who's willing to work hard can get ahead and become a millionaire and be a successful guy in America, because that's what we stand for, is anybody can succeed. Now it's more like people who are connected get automatic success and they don't have to work very hard to do it. And they, in many cases, do it at the expense of other people. people are really pissed off, and they're justifiably pissed off because the system is unfair. It doesn't allow entrepreneurship and hard work to be both appreciated and rewarded financially. Instead, it's basically the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer, and it sucks and it pisses people off. Now, if you happen to be a person of color, you're probably going to perceive what is really an unequal system, which has nothing to do with race, to be racist because, you know, I'm the guy who's getting dumped on. And I don't mean to suggest that racism doesn't exist, but if you're both the victim of a social inequality that's really more about the government's failure to promote the right kind of economic equality across all of society, if you're a victim of that and you're a victim of racism, then you're probably going to feel like the whole thing is mostly about racism, when in actuality, I would say racism is just one of many things that's adding to all of this inequality. Similarly, you know, if you have a liberal view and someone else has a conservative view, all of a sudden, it's not just personal opinions and ideology. It's like, this shit is really goddamn unfair. And the people it's unfair to are suffering and suffering really badly. I'm pissed off about it. I'm not going to tolerate your views if I disagree with them anymore. And what happens, unfortunately, is most people in society don't fully understand how all of this stuff works. So they've got very polarized views that are based on their own very incomplete understanding of what's really going on. They perceive, in many cases, this great racial injustice. Well, there is racial injustice, but there's a greater economic injustice that's across all of society. And it's because of Federal Reserve policy and a number of other factors. And it's because of cronyism and politicians essentially being for sale to the highest bidder through the campaign finance system. Those are the real problems. People just, they don't really understand how all that stuff works. And they say, well, I know this situation sucks and it sucks for me. Why? Well, must be racism, must be whatever. So I think that's how we get there. What's missing, you know, you asked me as an entrepreneur, what I would say is what the America that I grew up in, you were allowed to be an entrepreneur. We had President Reagan on the television saying, this is the age of the entrepreneur. If you don't like your job, forget your job, start a business, take control of your life, create employment for other people.
And big business was willing to letting them fail too. That's something that most people don't, they think of capitalism as just profit, but the loss is just as important. And we're not allowing these big businesses and corporations to actually fail.
Well, and all of these bailouts that we see, it's amazing to me that this mentality exists where you see people not just on the regular news, but on financial news, where the anchors are supposed to have at least a modicum of, you know, financial understanding, saying, well, of course, the government has to bail out the airlines. It's not their fault. Well, you know what? It's not the fault of the taxpayers who are footing that bill either. The whole idea of capitalism is investors put capital at risk in order to make a return. The idea is that rather than burdening society and the people with the risk of an airline failing, the investors who buy the stock and own that airline are taking that risk. They're greedy bastards like you and me who want to make a buck on the dividends from owning that stock. And we buy the stock knowing that we're taking a risk of losing our money if there's a pandemic, except not in this environment. We're stockholders. We're going to be protected by the government at the expense of providing a system that rewards people that are able to come in and say, hey, you know, I'm the entrepreneur who can say this system is failing. The way airlines work doesn't work anymore. We got to design new airplanes that have little pods in them. We got to do whatever. Those kind of entrepreneurs don't have a market to go and prevail and be successful in because the government is too busy spending billions and billions of taxpayer dollars bailing out the organizations that are failing, that aren't working. So
and the good actors who ran their business efficiently, who had savings for a rainy day. Generally, when those businesses that made bad decisions go bust for whatever reason, the good actors come in, take over those assets, and create a more efficient system moving forward. And we're not allowing that to happen.
That's exactly right. And we're creating moral hazard. We're teaching business executives that it makes no sense to be responsible and plan ahead and have capital reserves and be ready for a rainy day, because when the rainy day comes, the Fed's going to bail you out. And in fact, the thinner your balance sheet is, the better off you're going to be, because you'll be desperate and you'll qualify for more free money from the government. Exactly. So why in the world would you want to have a solid balance sheet that's going to allow congressmen to say, we don't need to bail this company out. They don't need the bailout. They're solid. Why would I put myself in the situation of not getting the handout when the next round of this happens? And, you know, that moral hazard is going to destroy, it is destroying capitalism. We don't have capitalism anymore. The great tragedy, I think, George, is most young people perceive capitalism as the problem. They don't really know what capitalism is. Capitalism would be the solution. If we went back to capitalism, we wouldn't have all these problems. But we have this government cronyism system where the government is constantly trying to control everything and bail everything out. It really, in many ways, is what we criticized the Soviet Union for, is central planning, trying to have the government be in charge of the economy. It's much better, we think, as Americans, to allow free market capitalism to choose the winners and the losers without trying to control it from some central planning authority. That was the whole basis of the Cold War. We thought that those values were so important that we risked ending humanity on Earth with nuclear war in order to fight for preserving those values. And what are we doing now? We're bailing out airlines whose executives are well connected with politicians, because we live in a corrupt crony system, which isn't far from the central planning of the Soviet Union. We don't call it communism, but in many ways it is corporate socialism. It is a bailout for those who are connected, and it has nothing to do with merit and everything to do with corruption and connection to elected officials and bribing them through campaign contributions.
I interviewed Ron Paul on Wednesday, and we had this discussion briefly, and we came to the conclusion that it would be a good idea if we kind of use the word capitalism, but more tried to use the words free market, because free market, I think, is such an easier sell to the average Joe and Jane out there on the street. You say, well, what do you think of capitalism? It's kind of one of those words that, well, it sounds a little evil. It sounds like the only people get ahead are the ones with capital. But if you say, what do you think of free markets? Everyone's like, well, of course. Yeah, that's definitely a good idea. It's kind of a no-brainer. But one thing I wanted to kind of circle back, because we started talking about the fourth turning. We started talking about these people who are really angry. And I think they're trying to find easy answers to complex questions. But the bottom line is they're pissed. And they're getting paid a lot to stay home right now. The unemployment rate is sky high. And another thing you've been talking a lot about on Macro Voices is this transition into UBI creating a higher inflation rate, because velocity increases, you get around the banking system. So if we have these people that are, or more people that are staying home, I assume the supply of goods and services decreases, while at the same time, the central banks and the government want to keep demand high by providing stimulus checks, let's call them, or indefinite UBI. So how does that play into your longer term outlook for inflation or stagflation in the US?
Well, I think ultimately, between now and the US presidential election, I don't expect a whole lot of money to come into people's hands, because the incentives are not there for politicians to put it there. Everybody who's anti-President Trump wants people to stay miserable for as long as Trump is in office, so that they can be the one when they enter office to make it all better. So that, you know, it was because it wasn't something Trump did at the end of his term. It was something that the new guy did at the beginning of their term. So nobody wants to make it better right now. And Trump knows that he doesn't have time, even if he did make it better, for it to make any difference. and losing those votes from conservatives who would not approve of something like UBI, you know, doesn't make sense, even if he wanted to get the votes that come from supporting something like UBI. So I don't think it happens until after the U.S. presidential election. But then I think, regardless of whether Trump is still in office or Biden wins or whatever happens next, I think that we're going to get to MMT and UBI and lots more money going into the real economy. And I think that that does lead to inflation. But I mean, look at how long most of us, myself included, made the mistake in 2009 of saying, wow, all of this money printing from the Fed with QE1, even though it was really just going into base money, into bank reserves, well, right. If we're creating trillions with a T, surely that's got to be inflationary at some point, right? Well, it's a decade later, and the inflation, I mean, there's been inflation, but there's been nothing like the runaway, you know, crazy inflation that some of us feared. I think that it could take 2 or 3 years after we start really pumping money into the broader economy before it catches up with us and we start to see that runaway price inflation. Mm-hmm. So I think it could be a few years away. And potentially, you know, one of the things people forget about inflation is they think, oh boy, inflation, bad thing. You know, just remember the 1970s. Well, the inflation didn't start in the 1970s. The inflation started in the mid-1960s. And inflation is a really great thing in the beginning, drives prices up, makes businesses more, profitable. I mean, it's really great when there's more money in the economy. People feel great at first. Then eventually that money velocity catches up with you and it leads to runaway price inflation. And you know, the bad parts of inflation start to happen. Mm-hmm. I predict, even though it's not my policy, I don't agree with it. Let's suppose that you had a Democratic sweep in the election. And that led to, you know, for sake of argument, Stephanie Kelton, the mother of MMT, becoming the next Fed chair. And the whole idea is, let's just see how much money we can possibly conjure out of thin air in order to provide support to universal basic income, to free healthcare for everybody.
Jobs for all, I think that's key too to inflation. The Jobs for Everybody program.
Name your own list of what all the, you know, free college tuition, free forgiveness of all existing student loans, all that stuff. A lot of people assume, because I don't favor those policies, that I must think that they would fail flat on their face. I don't think that at all, George. I think that they will be perceived as wildly successful mm-hmm. for the first few years. Because you're giving free stuff away. Of course, people are going to be happy with that. And the consequence of all of that free giveaway, which ultimately is runaway inflation, doesn't happen for 3 or 4 years. So for those first few years, whoever institutes this is going to look like a hero. And everybody before them who was a naysayer, who was against MMT and against that, is going to look just plain evil. Those right. sons of bitches that spoke out against this, look at how incredibly well it's going. Everybody's got UBI. It's not leading to runaway inflation like they said it would. Everything's great. You know, they're going to get a groundswell of just huge political support behind them because they proved guys like you and me wrong. Well, actually, they didn't prove us wrong. What happened was for the first 3 or 4 years of these new policies, the things that you and I fear didn't happen yet. And once we get to the point where they are happening, it will be too late to stop them. It doesn't matter what you do. You're going to have an inflationary depression at that point. And, I hope I'm wrong about that. But the way I see this going out is you and I look really bad for about 3 or 4 years. Before, I'm not sure that we look good. I think that people will have forgotten what our view was by the time it's actually proven true. So it doesn't bode well for our reputation or for the future of the economy, I don't think. But for a few years, it'll feel really good.
Yeah, I want to go back to a conversation. It was one of my favorite episodes of Macro Voices. It was your most recent conversation with Dr. Lacey Hunt. And it was just a fantastic interview. But you really, I don't know if people have told you this, but boy, you did a great job of just pushing him enough to get what we needed to hear. And where I'm going with that is Dr. Lacey Hunt, for those viewers who don't know, is very much on the deflation side of the argument, let's say. And he's just got a masterful understanding of what's going on, and he can articulate it so beautifully. But you kept trying to push him to say, okay, well, basically, what would make you change your mind? When would you go from being a deflationist to an inflationist? And he kind of was trying to wiggle out of it just a little bit, but you just did a masterful job of pushing him just a little bit in a polite way to get him to open up and say, listen, this is what would be required. But what really shocked me is he didn't say this is what would be required for me to go from having a deflationary stance to an inflationary stance. He leaped right over inflation and said this is what would make me go from a deflationist stance to a hyperinflation stance. Dr. Lacey Hunt. So can you walk us through the tail end of that conversation and remind us and try to explain to the viewers from Dr. Lacey Hunt's standpoint, what would be that catalyst from going from a deflationary bias to even Dr. Lacey Hunt going to a hyperinflationary bias?
Yeah, and I'm going to, if you don't mind, I'll add my own view into this,
because yeah, sure.
I hesitate to disagree with someone with just such an impeccable track record. I mean, Dr. Lacey Hunt is literally best in the business in the fixed yep. income world. He's widely respected in the industry. He's a way more accomplished guy than I am. And I would never want to take that away from him. But honestly, I don't understand his logic, because what he said is, look, as long as the Fed is able to provide liquidity, which is to say the Fed can buy bonds that already exist, you know, the bonds had to get issued by the government and sold to private buyers before, you know, the Fed's not allowed to directly monetize anything. That's against the law. The bonds that the government issues have to be sold to private buyers. And then sometime after that, if there's, a lack of liquidity in the system, the Fed can come along and buy some of those bonds that already exist from the private holders that have them. And that means the Fed is supplying liquidity to the market, but the Fed is not allowed to print and spend money. The Fed's only allowed to print money to use it to soak up liquidity where it's necessary in order to keep the market balanced.
Playing by the letter of the law.
And what he said was, where this all changes is if they ever change the Federal Reserve Act, which makes it illegal for the Fed to spend money, then just forget it at that point. He went, as you said, he stepped right over inflation to hyperinflation. He said that's where you get to end of the world kind of inflation stuff. And the thing that's fascinating to me, maybe I'm just more cynical than Dr. Hunt is I think it's pretty darn clear that the Fed has already shown us that they're going to usurp the intended meaning of the Federal Reserve Act by reinterpreting it to say something other than what it was written to say. You know, the Federal Reserve Act is very, very clear in saying the Fed is not allowed to buy private securities. What they can buy is government bonds and agency bonds, which means Freddie Mac's and the government agencies, which basically securitize mortgage securities. They're allowed to buy those because there's a government agency, even though it doesn't quite have the full faith and backing of the U.S. government as the creditor, which is really the kind of debt that they're supposed to buy. These agencies are close enough that we'll let them get away with it. Now, what the Fed has already done is to take that completely out of its intended context and say, well, it says agencies, and it was clearly intended to talk about agencies like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, but the U.S. Treasury is technically an agency of the government. So if we were to get the U.S. Treasury to go and buy a bunch of junk bonds, that's the stuff that is credit that is not investment grade, that anybody who's running a bond fund that investors are going to put their life savings in, is not allowed to buy because it's not credit worthy enough. And so the government doesn't allow anybody who's selling an investment grade instrument to buy these bonds because they are low quality credit and there's a good chance that they could default and never pay it back. Mm-hmm. So what if we took that junk bond crap that is way, way, way below investment grade? And what if we got the Treasury, our buddies there, who technically are an agency of the US government, to like put a wrapper around it, stamp it with their name on it, and then we could say that if they took those bonds and put them inside of another bond or what's called an SPV, a special purpose vehicle, right, that has the Treasury stamp of organization on it, well, then it's an agency bond and we're allowed to buy it. Well, so the Fed is clearly reinterpreting they're using a very liberal interpretation of the language in the Federal Reserve Act to interpret it to mean something that's clearly out of line with what its original intention was. Dr. Lacey Hunt seems to believe in justice or have more faith in justice than I do. He seems to say, look, the Federal Reserve Act is not allowing the Fed to spend money. I would argue when you look at, you know, the whole idea here, as I understand what Dr. Hunt's argument is the Fed can't directly monetize U.S. government bond issuance. They can't buy the bonds from the Fed. They have to buy them on the open market. So what happens is the Fed issues new bonds on Tuesday, and on Thursday of the same week, the primary dealers that bought them from the Fed sell them back. The primary dealers that bought them from the Treasury sell them back to the Fed a few days later at a markup. So not only are we usurping the intended meaning of the Federal Reserve Act and the government is breaking its own rules and making a mockery of its own legal system, but we're paying these fat cat bankers, the primary dealers, a commission for being the middleman to facilitate what is essentially an illegal transaction, or I mean, I think it's an illegal transaction. And one of the things that's been pointed out is, you know, in law, there's this concept called standing, which is, you know, if you go and do something, you know, your house is creating an eyesore or you're breaking the code things. I, as the guy who lives in another state, I can't sue you just because I don't like you because you're doing something wrong. The guy who lives next door to you, who's being affected by the thing that you're doing wrong by, you know, having more chimneys in your building than you're allowed to, or whatever the violation is that you're doing, that guy who's being directly affected by what you're doing wrong is said to have standing, legal word meaning he's allowed to sue you over it. Well, okay, who has standing against the Fed to say, hey, you violated the Federal Reserve Act by buying non-investment grade securities from the Treasury, claiming they're investment grade just because the Treasury's name is on them in this SPV, even though in reality you're conducting what is in effect a transaction that's prohibited by the spirit and intended meaning of the Federal Reserve Act? Well, the problem is it would be, I think, pretty easy to make that case in court that the Fed is undermining the intention of the Federal Reserve Act. Who has standing to bring that case? Nobody.
Private government.
So how do you, I mean, I guess the government itself has, the federal government could sue the Federal Reserve.
But they're benefiting.
The federal government wants to do that.
Yeah, they're benefiting from the shenanigans of the Fed getting around the Federal Reserve Act.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
What I want to unpack slightly for the viewer, the listener, is when Dr. Hunt was talking about if the Fed starts spending money, quote unquote, what does he mean by spending money? I mean, you talked about it there when they're monetizing the debt directly, but why would that create a hyperinflationary scenario and the Fed just printing up bank reserves? Because that's kind of money printing as well. Why does that not?
Okay, so if we start with, let's suppose that the Fed does what the Fed's already done for the last 10 years, which is they are conjuring money out of thin air. Now, it's not technically money printing because they're not physically printing Federal Reserve notes, the little dollar bills on paper. So it's not money printing, but it's creating US dollar money supply that didn't exist before. It's base money, it's bank reserves. What's happening is the Fed is saying, we're gonna take the primary dealers, the big banks that own all of these treasury bonds issued by the US government. We're gonna buy them from those guys so that those guys have money to use to go do something else with, whether it's to buy more of them from the government or to go invest in stocks. Or what they say it's for is, well, if we buy their treasury bonds, the banks are going to have lots of money. And once the banks have lots of money, they can use that as reserves to make loans to hardworking Americans. And we're going to stimulate the economy because all these banks will be lending again. I don't think they've ever meant that sincerely, because they could very easily write new laws that say, you know, we're going to create this program and whatever amount of reserves get created from this program, you have to use it for lending to people in need. That's the intention.
And they already abolished the reserve requirements, Eric.
And so what they do is they in front of the cameras, they say, oh, well, the reason for these policies is because what we're doing is we're making it possible for the banks to start lending again. In reality, what the banks are doing is speculating in the stock market. So stock prices go through the roof. The wealthy who own stocks end up benefiting from it. But the hardworking guy on Main Street gets nothing out of it. And it's horribly, horribly unjust. Now, what Dr. Hunt is saying is, if you want, without the Fed being involved, to give away a whole bunch of welfare programs, we're going to start universal basic income, we're going to make all college tuition free, we're going to forgive all past student loans. Well, what you'd have to do all of that would be to just tax a shitload of people, a lot of money, a lot of taxes would have to be raised to pay for all of that. What Dr. Hunt is saying is, if politicians were allowed to spend money like it's going out of style without taxing anybody, and instead just saying, look, we want to give away universal basic income, we want to give away college tuition, let's call our buddies at the Fed, let's have them print up a few trillion dollars. So what we can do is issue a whole bunch of treasury bonds, because we don't want to have to tax anybody. If we did that, we wouldn't get voted back into office. So we're not going to tax anybody. We're going to borrow money in the government's name with the issuance of bonds. And since smart people wouldn't loan us that money, we'll get the Fed to buy those bonds directly from the government. And once the Fed is buying bonds directly from the government, it basically gives us an unlimited checking account where we can give away anything, universal basic income, college tuition, you name it. It's not going to raise anybody's taxes, and we're going to be able to stay in power, and we're going to be able to do that. What Dr. Hunt is saying is, if it ever came to that, to where the Fed was spending money on UBI and on free tuition and so forth, that's pumping so much freshly created money into the real economy that after a while it would lead to not just inflation, but he's saying hyperinflation, runaway inflation, the kind of inflation that destroys entire nations and their economic systems. The part of it that I don't understand is why he thinks the Federal Reserve Act being amended by an act of Congress is such an important step to getting there, when it's already pretty clear that they're violating the intended meaning of the Federal Reserve Act already. They've reinterpreted the rules to be something that I don't think represents what was intended by the people who wrote it. And what they're doing too is, even though the Fed can't spend money by directly buying government bonds, the government can issue new bonds on Tuesday, knowing, and the people who are buying them, the primary dealers, know perfectly well they're only going to hold these 20-year or 30-year bonds for 20 or 30 hours before they turn them over and sell them back to the Fed. So of course there's a buyer. You know, the test is supposed to be the government can only issue bonds when there is a private investor, an investor in the free marketplace, who's willing to buy them. Well, of course there's somebody who's willing to buy them if the Fed has just announced we're going to buy, you know, $100 billion worth of Treasury securities on Friday. Well, if there's an auction on Monday where you can get a bunch of Treasury securities that you know you can not only turn over and sell, but sell at a markup on Friday, of course there's going to be a buyer for those securities.
I think it just goes back to the Fed being in control of the base money. That's where we stay in the groove that we're in now. But Dr. Hunt says if they start spending money, in other words, once they start to become more in control of broad money, that's when we got problems. That's when we got
right. And problems. I agree completely with Dr. Hunt that when we have problems is when the Fed starts spending money, as opposed to just using their money printing ability to supply liquidity to financial markets. The place I disagree with him is he's saying that can't happen without the Federal Reserve Act being rewritten. I'm saying all it takes is for the government to violate the Federal Reserve Act in an even bigger way than they already have, and they'll get away with it because there's nobody to stop them. So, you know, I don't see that it needs an act of Congress to happen. But other than that, he's got it exactly right. It's when the Federal Reserve starts spending money on programs that drive money into the broader economy, that's where we go to a hyperinflation risk.
Got it. Okay, so I know you're running short on time. I want to get your views on just kind of the basics. And one of my, probably my favorite part of Macro Voices every episode is when you just kind of go over your views of what's happened over the last week with Patrick. So I'd love to do that right now, just kind of broad strokes, what you're thinking about with in terms of oil, in terms of interest rates, the dollar, the stock market, gold, and maybe Bitcoin. I know that we had a really in-depth conversation on that last time, but I don't know if your views have changed or still consistent.
Okay, where do we start?
Let's start with oil. I mean, you're an expert there.
Okay. So crude oil was rallying really hard, V-shaped recovering from the coronavirus crisis. Got up to, and I had I'll credit myself for predicting this pretty darn accurately. I said, watch for that rally to stop somewhere between $41 and $42, which is exactly what it did. That was back on the 23rd of June that we kind of topped out there at 41 spot 63. It has just once on the 21st of July moved higher than that to 42 spot 50 or so. And I think the reason is that is the gap fill on the September chart, we rolled over onto the, from the August to the September contract, and that gap fill level was a little bit higher. But we haven't gotten above that, and we've been treading water at the same level. I've been expecting oil prices to correct lower because I'm convinced at the time what I was saying is I think a second wave is coming. Well, that was more than a month ago. Of course, the second wave is very, very clearly upon us. It's already here. To my own surprise, even though my prediction was confirmed, we do have the second wave of the coronavirus crisis very clearly upon us. We're at new records in daily new infections in the United States that are double what the old records were. You know, we've really got an issue here. But the thing is, at the same time, we've also had some very significant drawdowns in inventory. So the storage crisis that people had feared in terms of U.S. Commercial oil storage, has those risks have abated quite a bit. Okay. And we've also OPEC has begun to taper back their accommodation, but only by a little bit. And we've also got things like tropical storms that are always positive for oil, kind of holding things up. I feel like maybe finally after a month of treading water, we're in for some weakness here. I think there's still a dip to come in oil prices. But where I thought a month ago that we were headed, you know, okay, we went too far up. Now it's time to go have the other pendulum swing too far down, back down to, say, $20 to $25 on West Texas Intermediate before resuming an uptrend. It just feels like this market's got too much resilience in it for that, and we've burned off too much of those supplies. Meanwhile, I talked to a guy like Art Berman, who I know you've interviewed. Art's saying, look, we're going to have, over the course of the summer, we're going to have some completions of uncompleted wells. There's going to be kind of a booster shot to U.S. production that's going to help keep things going. But eventually, the massively depleted rig count and frac spread counts are going to catch up with us, and we're going to see a sharp decline in U.S. production. It's going to drive prices much higher. Wow. What Art and I both thought last time I spoke to Art about 2 months ago was, okay, here we are at $41. We managed to get here. We're going probably knee-jerk back down hard, but then when we go up, we're going to go up big, much higher, not just back to 40, but maybe back to 60. And we thought by the end of the year, maybe by Christmas, we might get up to, you know, $55 plus on West Texas Intermediate. I'd say that the way that my view has changed, I still think that that basic story is in play. The thing is, the weakness that we thought might get us down below $25, I'll be impressed if we get down to 30 again. Certainly if we touch 30, I think that's time to be buying, not selling, for sure. I'm already long time spreads in crude oil. I'd like to add to that position. I'm hoping for some weakness in the market so I can add to a long, not because I'm short, but because I want to add to my longs at a better location.
Got it. Okay, gold, silver.
Gold is really interesting. You know, we got to the daily close over 1800, which I thought was going to ignite a big rally higher. And for a week or so, it was like this delayed reaction. We had that technical signal that should have ignited, and it was just sort of lumbering along. And I'm thinking, boy, you know, is it me reading the chart wrong? I was really expecting it to take off. Then all of a sudden, when it took off, boy, did it ever take off. Well, we've moved up so much so quickly. We're back to new all-time highs. There's this formation in technical analysis called a cup and handle pattern. So if you look at what's happened since 2011, there was a peak. There's been this big cup in the price chart that goes, you know, from over here, it goes all the way up. And oftentimes you get this handle formation where what we might expect is, okay, we retested the all-time highs. Now it's time to drift down $100 or $150 for the next 6 months. And then after that, it really takes off and there's a moonshot higher in price. That's probably my base case as to what happens. But if you look at monetary policy and just how strong the argument is for why to be bullish gold, you know, it might just skip the handle and go straight up from here. On the other hand, if we had a really big upset in the presidential election, which I think is quite possible, I think we could have a big argument about delaying the vote. I think there's likely to be a huge amount of argument. Whoever wins is going to insist that it was a miscounting of the vote, you know, or I should say whoever doesn't win is going to insist that it was an unfair election and so forth. If that really started to cause a major dislocation in the stock market to the downside, let's say there's a Democratic sweep, which is probably not good for stocks to start with, and then there's a huge amount of uncertainty because everybody's suing each other and claiming the election was unfair and we have to, you know, vote again and all that kind of stuff. If you had a really big downside dislocation in stocks, even though in theory an uncertainty situation like that should be good for gold, if it started to pull gold to the downside, you've got so many weak hands in this market because it's gone straight up without any technical corrections. If that big technical correction got started, it could really take off to the downside. So I do see significant risks, but I think the most likely scenario is maybe $100, $150 of downside to kind of form that handle, and then big upside after that. Maybe straight to the big upside, maybe big down before the upside. But if there's, you know, the best scenario for gold investors, as far as I'm concerned, is the big down. That's your opportunity to really load up. Because if we got back down to $1,400 from here, oh boy, I would be backing up the leverage truck to buy a whole lot of gold there. To get excited about really adding to my existing positions here at 2,000 bucks or whatever it is, when we were at 1,300 just, you know, less than a year ago, you know, we've moved a lot. It's to move when you're already come, or to add to a position when you're already this far along, when there haven't been any technical corrections, it's kind of hard to justify.
Yeah. Okay. And again, Eric, I know we're short on time here. So just maybe quickly rate stocks. And if your position's kind of the same on Bitcoin, you don't have to elaborate on any of those if you don't want to.
Yeah. I'll say that on Bitcoin, I don't really have anything to say other than I think what's driving the current strength in Bitcoin is the same thing that's driving the strength in gold. Respectfully disagree with the Bitcoin maximalists who think that, you know, gold is a relic and Bitcoin is the new thing. I think ultimately in the long run that we're going to discover that digital currency is the way of the future. Bitcoin, kind of like the Wright Flyer, the world's first airplane, you know, it's where it all started. You'll never, ever forget Bitcoin. But does that mean that Bitcoin is still going to be, you know, we don't fly around on Wright Flyers today. We've got Boeings and Airbuses. I think technology will bring us better digital currencies. So I don't think that Bitcoin is the new scarcity asset for all time by any stretch, but it certainly is the popular trend right now. It's what younger people favor instead of gold as a safety asset that is favored in a condition of devalued fiat currency. Fiat currency systems all over the world, including the US dollar, will continue to be devalued in terms of their real purchasing power. That means gold and other scarcity assets are going to do well. That means Bitcoin will continue to do well for now. I have to admit, Bitcoin has lasted quite a bit longer than I first expected it to. Maybe I'll be wrong and it really will become the, you know, the de facto asset of the next 100 years. I don't think so. I think there's better distributed ledger technologies that overcome some of the shortcomings of Bitcoin's design that are better suited. But certainly the network effect that Bitcoin has already established is formidable. So we'll see what happens. But in one way or another, you know, I'm not going to make a bet on gold versus Bitcoin, which one wins better. The much easier bet to make is gold and Bitcoin win over U.S. dollars and other fiat currencies.
Right, right. Okay, so then just rates in the stock market.
Don't really have much to say on rates short term. The big question in my mind is we're at 60 or 57 basis points on the 10-year treasury right now. In the grand big picture scheme of things, we're basically flirting with zero here. You know, we came from 16-17% in 1982 down to, you know, a little more than 0.5%. Call that close enough to zero for big picture purposes. The question is there a boundary at zero where you just, it's the sovereign debt issue of the world's global reserve currency issuer. It can't go negative on yield because that's impossible. Well, is that really true? I think a lot of people thought it was impossible for German bond yields to go negative, and they've been negative now for years. So is zero a magic boundary that you can't go below on the U.S. 10-year, or is it just another number that's a stop along the way to negative yielding U.S. Treasury debt? I don't know the answer. I'm not smart enough to know the answer. I spend my time listening to smart guys like Dr. Lacey Hunt trying to figure that answer out. Stock market, right. I think what's going on with the stock market is we are being driven more by Fed supplied liquidity than we are by economic fundamentals. There's a lot of reasons to suspect that one way or another, the economy is going to get reopened. Doesn't mean that we're going to solve the COVID-19 problem by any stretch. But even if we don't, we're still going to reopen the economy because we have to. And there's going to be insane amounts of government stimulus thrown at this thing. It's one more excuse to print that much more money. So, you know, asset markets in general are going to continue to do pretty well. I can, in that environment, I can speculate in stocks and say, hey, I think even though it makes no economic sense for stocks to go up, I think they will anyway because of this liquidity. Well, that's kind of putting, you know, a greater fool bet on let me buy stocks thinking that the crazy market that we're in is going to lead somebody else to want to pay even more for them and I'll be able to unload them at a profit, even though I don't believe in the fundamentals. My other choice is to use that same investment capital and buy gold, which I believe very, very firmly is how I'm going to protect my purchasing power from the devaluation of fiat currency. For me, that's an easy choice to make. So the only stocks that I really think about buying are gold mining stocks and other stocks that have something to do with leveraging a position against the debasement of fiat currency. A broad macro, you know, let's just buy a basket of S&P 500 or something. Not for me, thanks.
Yeah, got it. All right, Eric.
And it's not that I don't think it won't go up. I think it's more likely to go up than go down, but I feel much more certain about gold.
Yeah, I know. It's just sad to say that you're so bearish on the fundamentals, but yet you're still seeing it going up. I mean, that just tells the whole story of the last 10 years and what we're living through right now. So for my viewers and listeners that want to find out more about what you do in your amazing podcast, where should they go?
Good. Just sign up for Macro Voices. You can either go to macrovoices.com or just type it into whatever your favorite podcast app is. We're on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and a whole bunch of others whose names I don't even know. And macrovoices.com is the website. It's Thursday nights, 8 p.m. that it's released. And it's much more advanced. It's not really for newbies. It is a podcast that is designed for high net worth individuals, family offices, and sophisticated private investors and finance professionals. So it's probably the most advanced investing and finance podcast on the internet.
Oh, without a doubt. And I cannot recommend it enough to everybody. Eric, I appreciate your time, buddy, and I can't wait to do it again.
Okay, it's my pleasure, George. Great to see you.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.